Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to explain the value of biomarker testing and targeted therapies for the personalized treatment of RET-altered thyroid cancers. This activity is funded by an educational grant from Blueprint Medicines and Genentech, a member of the Roche Group. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, Professor Maria Cabanillas will outline the different types of thyroid cancer, their epidemiology, and the range of multi-kinase and targeted kinase inhibitor therapies available for the management of the disease.
Hello, my name is Maria Cabanillas, and I'm an oncologic endocrinologist and tenured professor at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. I'm here to speak to you today about the different types of thyroid cancer, their epidemiology, and the range of treatment options currently available.
Can you describe the different types of thyroid cancer and the epidemiology of the disease?
Okay, so we'll start with the epidemiology of thyroid cancer, and then I'll talk about the different types of thyroid cancer. So it's estimated there will be 43,800 new cases of thyroid cancer in 2022. The incidence is rising, 6% annual increase from 97 to 2006. This is in part explained by better ultrasound techniques and more surveillance. However, it doesn't completely explain the rise in the larger tumors that have also been increasing since 1997. So these tumors are more common in women than in men. There's 2 to 3 times more common in women, and it's not necessarily understood why that is. There could be some hormonal reasons, also possibly more surveillance in women, but it's not entirely understood. The peak incidence of the disease is 40 to 49 years in women, 60 to 69 years in men, and the disease is more aggressive in men. So we'll talk a little bit about the different types of thyroid cancer. There are 3 major categories of thyroid cancer. Differentiated thyroid cancer comprises the largest category. And within differentiated thyroid cancer, we divide these tumors into papillary, follicular, Hürthel cell, and poorly differentiated thyroid cancer. Papillary thyroid cancer comprises the largest group, which is 90% of thyroid cancers, followed then by follicular, which is only 4.4%, and then Hürthel cell, which is a rare form of differentiated thyroid cancer, comprising only 1.5%. And then as these tumors become less differentiated, we call them poorly differentiated thyroid cancers, which is a more aggressive form of differentiated thyroid cancer. We do lump the poorly differentiated into the DTC category, and historically, clinical trials have included poorly differentiated thyroid cancer. The next category is anaplastic thyroid cancer, which is a completely dedifferentiated type of thyroid cancer, which originates from differentiated thyroid cancer, and it's the most aggressive form of thyroid cancer, thankfully only comprising less than 1% of all thyroid cancers. Unfortunately, it does cause the majority of deaths from thyroid cancer. And then there's medullary thyroid cancer, which is a rare form of thyroid cancer. Again, only 1.5% of thyroid cancers. What's interesting about this tumor is that it really originates from C cells, which are neuroendocrine cells that live in the thyroid gland, but are not necessarily the thyroid cells. Now, these tumors are interesting because they comprise they are 25% of them are hereditary, and these patients have a constellation of different types of tumors, and these are called MEN2. And so all patients with medullary thyroid cancer need to be screened for hereditary forms of the disease. I want to explain a little bit about the differentiated thyroid cancers, poorly differentiated thyroid cancers, and anaplastic thyroid cancers. So the mutations in these diseases are very important because we now have targeted therapies for some of these. And so When you look at papillary thyroid cancers, the majority of these tumors are going to have a BRAF V600E mutation. That's going to be about 60 to 70% of your papillary thyroid cancers will have a BRAF mutation. In follicular thyroid cancer, we see more RAS mutations. Rarely we can see PAX8 PPAR gamma fusions, which have been reported. And then in Hürthle cell, oftentimes we don't see many mutations. When you do see mutations, we sometimes see RAS mutation, DICER1 mutations. And unfortunately, those are not really actionable. Now, when we talk about poorly differentiated thyroid cancer, we're simply talking about a tumor that has been derived from a well-differentiated thyroid cancer, a papillary follicular Hürthle cell, which has now lost some of the usual tumor markers and the ability to make thyroglobulin. And so these are categorized still as differentiated thyroid cancer, but they're a more aggressive form of differentiated thyroid cancer. And sometimes you can't really differentiate what cell it originated from. And then anaplastic thyroid cancer, like I said, is an undifferentiated type of thyroid cancer. That means that you really can't tell under the microscope from what tumor this derived from. It has lost the ability to make the tumor marker thyroglobulin and always behaves incredibly aggressively. You will oftentimes see that an anaplastic thyroid cancer under the microscope will have right next to it a well-differentiated thyroid cancer, and then you know from which tumor it came from. So as I mentioned previously, 25% of medullary thyroid cancers occur as a hereditary syndrome called MEN2 syndrome. And these patients, almost all of them have a germline RET mutation. About half of patients with sporadic medullary thyroid cancer, so these are ones that do not have the hereditary form of the disease, about half of them are going to have a RET mutation, the most common being RET918 mutation, which is found in about 40% of cases.
Can you outline the different multikinase inhibitors and their uses in the treatment of thyroid cancer?
There are several multikinase inhibitors that are approved in the United States for thyroid cancer. There are two for medullary thyroid cancer, vandetanib and cabozantinib. And there are three that are approved for differentiated thyroid cancer, which are sorafenib, lenvatinib, and then cabozantinib as second line in differentiated thyroid cancer. That was a recent approval. We'll start with vandetanib. This is a drug that is approved for medullary thyroid cancer. The study was designed in a way where patients did not have to have progression in order to enter the study. And medullary thyroid cancer oftentimes is a very indolent disease. And so what you see is that the median progression-free survival is very long in the placebo arm, is 16.4 months, whereas in the treatment arm, it was not reached. The overall response rate was very good at 44%. Cabozantinib was the next drug that was approved for medullary thyroid cancer, and the response rate in medullary thyroid cancer was 27%. With a progression-free survival in the placebo arm of 4 months versus 11 months in the treatment arm. Sorafenib was the first drug that was approved for differentiated thyroid cancer. The response rate was 12%. The median progression-free survival in the placebo arm was about 6 months, where it was about 11 months in the treatment arm. And then lenvatinib was approved for differentiated thyroid cancer. The overall response rate was much higher than sorafenib at 65%. These patients did have more aggressive disease than the sorafenib patients, so the treatment population is slightly different, with a median progression-free survival of 3.6 months in the placebo arm and 18.3 months in the treatment arm. And then cabozantinib most recently was approved for second-line therapy in differentiated thyroid cancer. And in differentiated thyroid cancer, they had an overall response rate of 15%. The progression-free survival in the placebo arm was 1.9 months, and it was not reached in the treatment arm for that drug.
What, in your experience, are the limitations of multikinase inhibitors in the treatment of thyroid cancer?
So the multikinase inhibitors that are approved for thyroid cancer are a class of drugs called antiangiogenics because they target VEGF receptors. Because of targeting VEGF receptor, we see this constellation of different adverse events with multikinase inhibitors and their class effects. And so probably the most common one is hypertension. And depending on the drug, because the different drugs have different potencies, you get more hypertension with some of them, such as with lenvatinib and cabozantinib, than you do with the weaker VEGF receptor inhibitors, such as sorafenib and vedotinib. We also do see a lot of fatigue, decreased appetite, and weight loss. Particularly with lenvatinib and cabozantinib, we see a tremendous amount of weight loss. And sometimes we need to stop these drugs in order to let the patient gain some weight back. We can see proteinuria, which is likely an issue with that relates to hypertension. Musculoskeletal disorders such as arthralgias and myalgias are also sometimes found, not at a very high rate. Diarrhea, nausea, and stomatitis are adverse events, particularly related to the more potent VEGF receptor inhibitors. Skin and cutaneous disorders are also a problem. We do see some rash that's mostly associated with vedotinib and sorafenib. But palmar plantar erythrodysesthesia is also called hand-foot syndrome, is a problem with all of these drugs, where you can have callus formations on the pressure points of the hands and feet. So we ask patients to have calluses shaved off, particularly before getting started on therapy, because they can develop these very thick calluses on their feet, sometimes on their hands if they use their hands a lot. And these can be quite painful and difficult to manage.
Can you outline the available targeted kinase inhibitors and their uses in the treatment of thyroid cancer?
We also have selective kinase inhibitor therapies that are approved in the United States for different types of thyroid cancer. These drugs are targeted towards the particular mutation that we're seeing in the tumor. So we'll start with dabrafenib and trametinib. So this is a combination of a BRAF inhibitor and a MEK inhibitor. It's approved for anaplastic thyroid cancer with a BRAF V600E mutation. This essentially is the biggest breakthrough in anaplastic in the past decades, because we saw an overall response rate of 61%. Entrectinib and larotrectinib are NTRK inhibitors. These are drugs that are approved for solid tumors with NTRK fusions, but not NTRK mutations. It really only works for the fusions. We have reported on the thyroid cancer population, and the response rate in these patients is incredibly high, 60 to 100% with entrectinib and larotrectinib. Pralsetinib and selpercatinib are selective RET inhibitors. They're approved for thyroid cancers with a RET mutation, which essentially would be medullary thyroid cancer, since we see quite a bit of RET mutation in that cancer, and for RET fusion thyroid cancer. For pralsetinib in medullary thyroid cancer, the response rate was 60 to 66%. And the reason there's a range here is because they did divide up the patients into previously treated and treatment naive patients. That's why you see the range. The patients that had fewer responses are the ones who were previously treated, as expected. So for RET fusion thyroid cancers, there was an 89% response rate, very high response rate in this population of RET fusion. Selpercatinib is also approved for these patients with RET fusions and RET mutations. In medullary thyroid cancer, the response rate was 69 to 73%. For RET fusion thyroid cancers, the response rate was 79 to 100%. And so these patients have very good outcomes the ones that have RET fusions with these selective RET inhibitors. They are rare patients, but you know, which is the reason why we need to really look for these fusions in these different types of thyroid cancers.
Can you describe the adverse effects you have seen associated with targeted kinase inhibitors?
The selective kinase inhibitors have very different types of adverse events. They're very different from the VEGF receptor inhibitors. So with the BRAF inhibitors, what we see, and depending on the BRAF inhibitor, but for dabrafenib, we see a lot of fever. And sometimes these patients can become dehydrated from having such high fevers, and they're very uncomfortable. They can also have chills that are associated with that. These patients eventually stop having fevers after several months. We can see a little bit of hypertension with the MEK inhibitor drugs, but this is very mild compared to the VEGF receptor inhibitor drugs. We also do see some hand-foot syndrome that I described previously with the VEGF receptor inhibitors. We can see that with the BRAF inhibitors. Now, when you combine it with a MEK inhibitor, some of these adverse events are not as pronounced. So one of the differences that I've seen when you combine a BRAF inhibitor with a MEK inhibitor is that you have fewer cutaneous issues. So it's an interesting finding that combining a drug would actually make an adverse event better. It was one of the kind of newer things that we discovered. The NTRK inhibitors have few side effects, but one of the major ones is that these patients can become dizzy and feel very off-balanced. You can also have pyrexia, fatigue, cough, diarrhea, constipation, and some musculoskeletal pain. But I would say that the most bothersome is the dizziness, and these patients eventually do adjust and start being able to kind of recalibrate. So with the selective RET inhibitors, we get patients complaining of fatigue, edema, headaches, hypertension. The hypertension that we see with selective RET inhibitors is much less than it is with VEGF receptor inhibitors. We also see diarrhea and constipation, although diarrhea oftentimes in the medullary thyroid cancer patients who have baseline diarrhea, if they respond to the RET inhibitor, you'll see that their diarrhea actually improves greatly and patients are much more comfortable. The other things, gastrointestinal side effects that we see with these drugs are liver function abnormalities, and then we can see myelosuppression with some of the RET inhibitors.
Thank you for that comprehensive overview, Professor Cabanillas. Now let's move on to our next interview, where Dr. Vivek Subbiah will explain the concept of RET alterations in thyroid cancer, the methods available to detect these biomarkers, and how detecting RET alterations can influence treatment decision-making and patient outcomes.
My name is Vivek Subbiah, and I'm the Center Medical Director at the Clinical Center for Targeted Therapy at the University of MD Anderson Cancer Center, Houston, Texas. Today, I'm going to talk about how biomarker testing is key to improving outcomes in patients with RET-altered thyroid cancers.
What is currently known about RET alterations in patients with thyroid cancer and how these alterations affect patient prognosis?
Genome-driven precision oncology has altered the therapeutic landscape of multiple kinase-driven solid tumors. The use of imatinib in BCR-ABL fusion-positive chronic myelogenous leukemia and the recent use of crizotinib in ALK fusion and ROS1 fusion positive non-small cell lung cancer are prime examples of transformative first-generation kinase inhibitor therapies. 25 years ago, inherited mutations of the RET gene were identified as a cause of hereditary form of multiple endocrine neoplasia type 2, which is MEN2, which was soon followed by the discovery of somatic activating RET aberrations, genetic fusions, or mutations in diverse malignancies warranting their choice as prospective therapeutic targets. RET fusions are seen as driver alterations in papillary thyroid cancers, whereas somatic RET alterations are seen in 100% of hereditary form of medullary thyroid cancer and as sporadic form in over 60% of medullary thyroid cancers. Again, this gain of function point mutation is associated with aggressive disease. And in fact, early thyroidectomy, especially in patients with children, is required in children who have inherited form of the MEN type 2 syndrome. Let's go back to the RET fusions. It's present in 10 to 20% of papillary thyroid cancer and 1% of anaplastic thyroid cancer and in multiple other forms of thyroid cancer as well. RET rearrangement is an early event in tumorigenesis. It strikes adolescent and young adults, and it's most common in young patients less than 39 years of age in their prime of their lives.
What methods are available to detect RET alterations, and what, in your opinion, are the challenges faced by clinicians with each method?
Several approaches are available for the detection of RET alterations. The choice will be guided by the type of alteration to screen, mutation versus fusion, and the context of the tumor. Is it medullary thyroid cancer? Is it papillary thyroid cancer? Or anaplastic thyroid cancer, among others? Or the context also includes the medullary thyroid cancer oncogenetics, which is the germline testing, or theranostics. The quantity and quality of tissue available and the potential alterations to screen depending upon the tumor types and cost. As for oncogenetic analysis, germline testing should be considered for patients who are member of families where RET gene mutations have been identified, or for those patients with families known to be affected by inherited medullary thyroid cancer of unknown RET alteration status. Approximately 10% of MEN cases and 2% of MEN2A and 50% of MEN2B arise from de novo germline mutations. In addition, germline RET testing should be considered in the following select cases: as an alternative to annual biochemical serum calcitonin testing to screen C-cell hyperplasia for patients diagnosed with aberrant sporadic medullary thyroid cancer, or first-degree relatives of patients with sporadic medullary thyroid cancer, and finally for patients with clinical diagnosis of MEN2 or primary C-cell hyperplasia. Finally, detection of RET alterations can also be useful in some selected settings as a tool to assist in differential diagnosis of indeterminate thyroid nodules on fine needle aspiration specimens. So what are the in situ assays available? The first one is immunohistochemistry. The second one is the FISH or the fluorescent in situ hybridization. The third one are nucleic acid-based assays, which is the DNA PCR-based assay, the RNA PCR-based assay, the DNA next-generation sequencing assay, and the RNA next-generation sequencing assays. So this will all depend upon the context where we want to get the testing done. Let's first talk about immunohistochemistry. Immunohistochemistry is a diagnostic aid that detects overexpression of RET protein. This is not suitable for screening due to issues related to reliability and accuracy. FISH, the fluorescent in situ hybridization. It's a well-established method, especially for the detection of RET fusions. One of the main challenges is it is difficult to interpret and has very low specificity. Again, it is not suitable as a part of multiplex screening. So what are the next techniques? As we discussed, the PCR-based techniques, which are DNA-based and RNA-based. The DNA-based techniques are suitable for known mutations in familial medullary thyroid cancer. It can screen for both hotspot mutations limited by detecting number of primers used. Unfortunately, the DNA-based assays are not suitable for detecting fusions. What do we do for detecting fusions? We use the RNA-based testing. This is suitable for detecting fusions provided the primer is present. Detection of unknown fusion partners depends on the expression level and is therefore very unreliable in this setting. So let's talk about the NGS assays in detail. The DNA-based NGS assay. This has high sensitivity, allowing detection of very low allele frequencies. multiplex here is possible and reduces the amount of tissue required. What about RNA-based technology? It removes the challenge for intron-based coverage, determines whether a red fusion is present in frames of the aberration. Again, this is a qualitative assessment of RNA is necessary to ensure accuracy. So let's talk about what everyone is talking about, liquid biopsy. One of the main advantages of liquid biopsies is that it is minimally invasive. So what is liquid biopsy? This is the testing of nucleic acids isolated from biological fluids from the shed part of the tumor, which is circulating in the blood. This is suitable for patients with limited or no tumor tissue available. As I said earlier, this is minimally invasive. This is highly sensitive with NGS. This is compatible with monitoring during follow-up. The limited quantity of circulating cell-free DNA and circulating cell-free RNA in plasma may mean additional testing is required. So liquid biopsy is becoming a part of the important molecular testing in patients with thyroid cancer.
What are the benefits of detecting RET alterations in patients with thyroid cancer? And how can the information be used for treatment decision-making?
Although RET was one of the earliest genes to be cloned and several multikinase inhibitors with RET inhibitory activity, patients with RET-driven malignancies, especially RET fusion-positive thyroid cancers and medullary thyroid cancer, have derived only modest benefit from multikinase inhibitors when compared to other selective inhibitors, as their response rate and duration of response are lower when we compare to other selective kinase drugs, such as ALK or ROS1. The recent development, clinical translation, and registrational clinical trials of not one but two selective RET inhibitors, pralsetinib and selpercatinib, has changed this paradigm. So RET therapeutic targeting has changed the outcome of patients with advanced medullary thyroid cancer and advanced RET fusion positive thyroid cancers. Pralsetinib received FDA approval in 2020, and another drug, selpercatinib, also received FDA approval in 2020 for RET-driven thyroid cancers. The objective response rates are over 60 to 70% with both these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And they are active in both RET mutant and RET fusion positive thyroid cancers. The 12-month progression-free survival rate is also over 80%. So both are very well tolerated with very low discontinuation rates and dose reduction rates when we compare that with the previous multi-kinase inhibitors. So there is considerable enthusiasm in the precision oncology of RET-driven thyroid cancers, mainly stemming from these selective RET inhibitors. The fewer off-target side effects, more effective control of growth, and sustained anti-tumor activity when compared with multikinase inhibitors opens up a new era of precision oncology and RET-driven advanced medullary thyroid cancer and RET fusion positive thyroid cancers. So the recent approval of these agents has increased the use of these drugs in the community. The current RET inhibitors are proof of principle for selective RET inhibition. Now, the key is to identify these patients so that they can benefit from these treatment options, so that we can treat the right patient at the right time within the right clinic.
Thank you for those useful insights, Dr. Subbiah. Now let's move on to our next interview, where Dr. Laurie Wirth will review the latest efficacy and safety data on targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapies for patients with RET-altered thyroid cancers and their implications for clinical practice.
Hello, my name is Dr. Laurie Wirth, and I'm the medical director of the Center for Head and Neck Cancers at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, USA. Today, I'll be talking about the key takeaway data from the latest clinical trials on treatments for RET-altered thyroid cancers.
What does the latest clinical evidence tell us about the efficacy of pralsetinib in RET-altered thyroid cancers?
The ARROW trial is an ongoing phase 1-2 trial of pralsetinib in RET-altered solid tumors. There were three thyroid cancer cohorts in ARROW. There was a cohort of 61 patients with RET mutant MTC that had received prior systemic therapy. And there was a RET mutant MTC cohort with no prior systemic therapy. And then there was a smaller cohort of RET fusion positive thyroid cancer. There were 61 patients in the previously treated MTC group, 23 patients in the systemic therapy naive MTC group, and 11 patients in the RET fusion positive thyroid cancer group. All of these patients received 400 milligrams of pralsetinib once daily as the for the efficacy analysis. And the primary outcome of the ARROW trial was objective response rate. Secondary outcomes included a duration of response, clinical benefit rate, disease control rate, PFS, and overall survival. Now, the Accelerate MTC trial will compare pralsetinib to investigator's choice, cabozantinib or vandetanib in RET mutant MTC that is progressive in patients who have not received any prior systemic therapy. For the primary endpoint of ARROW, the objective response rate in patients with RET mutant MTC that had received prior systemic therapy was 60%. There were 2% of patients who had complete responses, but the majority of responses were partial responses. For the RET mutant MTC patients without prior systemic therapy, the objective response rate was 71%, with a 5% rate of complete response and 67% of patients achieving a partial response. For the RET fusion positive thyroid cancer patients, the objective response rate was 89%, and all of these were partial responses. Now, we saw fairly long duration of response in ARROW. For all three thyroid cancer cohorts, the median duration of response had not yet been reached at the time of last follow-up. The probability of ongoing response at 1 year was 92% in patients with previously treated MTC, 84% in patients without prior therapy who had medullary thyroid cancer, and then 86% in RET fusion positive thyroid cancer. For the progression-free survival in the ARROW trial, all three cohorts had not yet reached the median progression-free survival at the time of last follow-up. However, the 12-month PFS rate was 75% in previously treated MTC, 81% in patients who had not received prior therapy with MTC, and then 81% for patients with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer.
What does the latest clinical evidence tell us about the efficacy of selpercatinib in RET-altered thyroid cancers?
The LIBRETTO-001 trial examined selpercatinib in a phase 1-2 trial in RET-altered solid tumors. And we recently presented data at the 2021 ASCO, updated data in the 2021 ASCO for the thyroid cancer patients enrolled on LIBRETTO-001. There were four cohorts we reported on, RET mutant MTC patients that had received prior vandetanib and or cabozantinib, RET mutant MTC without prior vandetanib or cabozantinib. There was a thyroid cancer cohort with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer that had received prior systemic therapy, and then RET fusion positive thyroid cancer without prior systemic therapy. The objective response rate was the primary endpoint, with secondary endpoints including duration of response, PFS, clinical benefit, and of course, safety. Now, the LIBRETTO-531 trial is underway. LIBRETTO-531 is comparing selpercatinib to investigator's choice, vandetanib or cabozantinib, in patients with RET mutant MTC who had not received any prior systemic therapy and have progressive disease. Importantly, patients as young as 12 years of age are eligible for enrollment. In terms of the primary endpoint of objective response, in patients with MTC who had received prior cabozantinib, vandetanib, or both, the objective response rate in the 143 patients was 69%. And in those patients who had not received prior systemic therapy, the objective response rate was 71% in the updated analysis of the 112 patients. four patients with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer who had received prior systemic therapy. The objective response rate was 77%. And in those patients who had not received any prior systemic therapy with RET fusion positive disease, the objective response rate was 92%. Now, in terms of duration of response, we're seeing a very long durability. The median duration of response has not yet been reached for the patients with MTC who had been previously treated. For the patients without prior systemic therapy with MTC, the median duration of response was 22 months. It was 18 months for the patients who had previously treated RET fusion positive thyroid cancer, and then the median duration of response has not yet been reached for patients with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer who had not received prior systemic therapy. In terms of progression-free survival, again, we're seeing very long progression-free survival rates. The medians have not yet been reached. However, in patients with RET mutant MTC who had received prior therapy, the updated 12-month PFS rate is 77%. In those patients who have not received prior systemic therapy with MTC, the updated 12-month PFS rate is 93%. For patients with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer who had received prior systemic therapy, the 12-month PFS rate is 69%. And then for patients who had not received any prior systemic therapy with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer, the 12-month PFS rate is 100%.
What can you tell us about the toxicity profiles of pralsetinib and selpercatinib and how they compare with multikinase inhibitors?
In terms of safety on the ARROW trial with pralsetinib, the most common treatment-related adverse events that were seen in 25% of patients or more include increased AST, a decreased white blood cell count, neutropenia, hypertension, anemia, constipation, and asthenia. Serious treatment-related adverse events occurred in 15% of patients on the ARROW trial, and 4% of patients discontinued due to treatment-related adverse events. There was one death attributed to a treatment-related adverse event, which was in a patient who was diagnosed with interstitial pneumonitis. For selpercatinib, as was seen in the LIBRETTO-001 trial, the most common treatment-emergent adverse events seen in 25% of patients or more include dry mouth, diarrhea, hypertension, fatigue, and constipation. A majority of the treatment emergent adverse events were low grade, and selpercatinib had to be discontinued due to treatment-related adverse events in 2% of patients. When we think about the grade 3 or higher adverse events that are seen with the RET-specific inhibitors compared to multikinase inhibitors, with the RET-specific inhibitors, we see dyspnea, diarrhea, fatigue, and hypertension. Whereas with the multikinase inhibitors, we see QTC prolongation, fatigue, proteinuria, diarrhea, decreased appetite, decreased weight, palmar plantar erythrodysesthesia, and hypertension in up to 44% of patients. So I reviewed the long list of side effects that can be seen with the MKIs and the relatively shorter list of side effects that can be seen with the RET-specific inhibitors. What we see in clinic, I think, is that the patients do tolerate the RET-specific inhibitors better overall. We definitely have to decrease the doses of RET-specific inhibitors far less frequently than with multikinase inhibitors and discontinue therapy far less due to treatment-related adverse events with the RET-specific inhibitors. I think overall, the RET-specific inhibitors don't have as much impact on patients' day-to-day activities than the multikinase inhibitors, and patients are able to do more of their usual work and home activities on the RET-specific inhibitors.
What are the implications of the efficacy and safety data for pralsetinib and selpercatinib for daily clinical practice?
Well, in terms of practical implications, both agents can cause hypertension. We have to manage hypertension generally with antihypertensives rather than dose reduction or dose discontinuation. We want to optimally manage the hypertension with medications. And I'd say with the RET-specific inhibitors, we're usually able to do this and don't have to dose reduce. However, of course, dose holds may be necessary. Dose reductions may be necessary for hypertension. If there's very severe hypertension, of course, it's possible that there has to be dose discontinuation. Hemorrhagic events have been described with both agents. They should be withheld for grade 3 or higher hemorrhagic events. And selpercatinib or pralsetinib, of course, should be discontinued if there is life-threatening bleeding. Hepatotoxicity can also be seen with both drugs. We definitely have to monitor the AST and ALT hold therapy if there is grade 3 or higher adverse events, and then dose reduce if necessary. If there is uncontrolled liver toxicity, then the therapy will need to be discontinued. This is quite rare, however, with both agents. Diarrhea can be seen with selpercatinib and pralsetinib. It's generally fairly mild and generally can be managed with lifestyle and dietary changes, occasionally with antidiarrheal medication as well. Fatigue can be seen as a side effect of the therapy that is generally tolerable for patients. Now, pralsetinib has caused interstitial pneumonitis in a small subset of patients and should be held for grade 1 or 2 pneumonitis, dose reduced if it is going to be restarted. And pralsetinib should be discontinued if there's a grade 3 or higher interstitial pneumonitis. And then with selpercatinib in particular, a small subset of patients do experience meaningful prolongation in the QTC interval. The QTC interval on EKG does need to be monitored prior to and on therapy. Selpercatinib should be held if there's a grade 3 or higher QTC prolongation, and then dose reduced once the QTC prolongation has improved, and should be discontinued if there's a grade 4 QTC prolongation. Hypersensitivity has been seen with selpercatinib as well, and selpercatinib should be held if this is encountered, and corticosteroids may need to be initiated. The therapy may be restarted at a decreased dose. Now, how do we decide between starting pralsetinib or selpercatinib in any given patient with RET-altered thyroid cancer who needs systemic therapy? I think it's a difficult decision. There are some differences in the side effect profile, as I mentioned here. And another difference is that pralsetinib is given just once daily, whereas selpercatinib is dosed twice daily. For some patients, that may make a difference. And then on the other hand, pralsetinib does have a little bit more bone marrow suppression than seen with selpercatinib, and that may make a difference for some patients as well. So I think that the decision is definitely individualized, taking into account all of these aspects of the two different drugs.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchoncology.com.